Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, June 7th. Before we begin our work, would you please do a roll call for committee members?
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Present by video.
Representative Smith.
Excused, but we believe he will be able to join us in a while.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you. We have a number of items on our agenda. I'd like to explain to everyone what our agenda will be like. So in case there's something you're really eager to hear about, you'll know the order of the agenda and what's going on. We have two public hearings. Those will be at the beginning of the meeting, House Bill 2434 and Senate Bill 141A. That will be followed by a work session on House Bill 3295. House Bill 2070 is on our printed agenda, but we will not be having a work session on 2070. I am carrying that over to the next meeting. Again, carrying over House Bill 2070. Then we will do work sessions on House Bill 2456 and 2438. Those work sessions will be for discussion purposes, but we don't have all of the paperwork, so we will not be doing motions and voting on those two. And the last item on the agenda is House Bill 2447. We will not be having a work session on House Bill 2447. And when we get to that point in the agenda, I will explain my thinking on that. Okay, let's start with the top of the agenda. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2434.
Yes, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, House Bill 2434. Today you have in the amended version and the amendments that are present in front of you. Primarily the dash 2, 3, and 4, they're very similar, but the meat basically is the same. So you have the amendments all replacing the measure, and what the amendments do, they actually remove the sunset on the tax increase that happened in 2015 for the jet fuel tax. The jet fuel tax was increased from 1 to 3 cents, and the aviation gasoline from 9 to 11 cents, of course, including more gas. And the sunset would have occurred on January 1st, 2022. So this bill primarily removes that sunset and allows for the tax rates to continue being 3 cents and 11 cents on aviation gas and jet fuel. Then the bill also goes into changes for the distribution or the required programs to be spent for the revenue to be spent on, and changes those percentages. And I could go through those percentages later on if you would like, but they're all in your background material in the SMS under the background for the dash 2 amendment. The dash 2 amendment also requires reports by the Department of Aviation, from biennial reports to annual reports, and primarily requires projects to be built for the new revenue. The dash 3 amendment is the same as you would have in the dash 2. The difference with the dash 3 is that it included in the title of the amendment the 3/5 requirement that is required for the revenue raising bill that was absent in the dash 2 inadvertently. Dash 4 fixes an issue that was missed during the process of amending, and it primarily talks about extending commercial leases for the Department of Aviation can go in from 30 years to 50 years. The programs that change in the distribution are in the middle of your SMS. You can go through what the critical, like an airport relief, how the changes from the 50% to 75% of the revenue, and so on, and how these things change. If you would like, I could go through after you hear from your witnesses that want to address this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for that information. Committee members, do you have any questions for Mr. Malik right now, or can we hear from our colleague, Representative McLean, who's with us to explain how this amendment got to us?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to come and testify on this amendment and also on the bill, House Bill 2434. This was in our ombudsman bill in joint transportation, and because it is a 3/5 vote, we felt that it was important to put it in its own bill so that we can have this there as an issue. I would like to maybe add a little information about the bill itself, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, first of all, I want you to know that the only thing that this bill does as far as the fuel tax is it takes off the sunset. It is the same tax that we've had since 2015. And as the speaker indicated, we moved from 9 cents to 11 cents per gallon for fuel that was sold to a dealer or distributed. We also moved from 1 cent to 3 cents per gallon for fuel sold to operate turboprop or jet engine aircraft. So please remember, we are not adding additional taxes. We are keeping the tax that's been in place since 2015. Also, it's important to remember that what we are trying to do here is we are also giving, as the speaker who spoke in front of me indicated, that we are trying to make sure that the 28 state airports, and these are the 28 state-owned airports, are able to use the dollars and the funds for matching dollars with the federal government, so we end up with more dollars for the state of Oregon and our airports, and that these are for 28 state airports that are across the state. Some are in rural areas, some are medium, and some are very small airports. So every single project, every single maintenance project, or any type of development project is extremely important. And remember that the folks that are in agreement with this sunset coming off are the folks that are taxing themselves. And so those are folks including the Oregon Airport Management Association. We have the Josephine County Airports. We have the Oregon Pilots Association, Alaska Airlines, the Aircraft Owners and Pilot Associations, SEIU 49, SEIU 503, and the Oregon aviation industry, and also the city of Prineville. So we did not have anyone that was speaking against this particular bill, because these are folks that want to keep their airports pristine and maintained. They want to be able to develop those airports as needed and necessary, and they want to be able to qualify for federal grants and have matching dollars. And so I'm going to keep it simple. Nothing will have changed after we voted on this, except for a very proven process that's been in place since 2015. This actually was the very first bill I ever voted on as a legislator in the House Transportation committee, so I remember it well. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you've got them.
Thank you, Representative McLean. Rep Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is for Mr. Malik or Representative McLean, but just so I'm clear on I think the dash, all the dashes, is the current method of distribution of these funds is 50% to CORE, 25% to ROAR, and 25% to SOAR. And it sounds like that we're going to increase the CORE percentage from 50 to 75, and then keep SOAR at 25, so that's the full 100%. And then ROAR, does ROAR go away then as far as a place where the money goes? If all that makes sense. I'm not a poet, so I couldn't put that in rhyming meter. So I'll let those who can do.
Representative Reschke, the 75%, as you noted correctly, that the rural program becomes part of that. So rather than being on its own, it kind of merges into the program itself.
Okay, and that the reason, I'm sorry, a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure, yes.
Thank you. So Mr. Malik, the reason for that is so that we can get matching dollars on that. Where it sits right now, I'm assuming we don't have the ability to get matching dollars on that.
I believe that is correct. However, I think the as the program progressed, the criteria of which amounts of money you spend first, second, and third, that is also no longer, I believe, is in the bill. So therefore, the choice is left to the board and to the department to establish their priorities as the law or as they need. So that's what the new bill gives them the flexibility to do in order what to spend the money on.
Thank you.
Thanks. Rep McLean, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I wanted to let you know our director, Ms. Atterbury, is here. If there are any more specific questions about the board or about the process, I'm sure she'd be happy to add to that. But this, again, is a program that we're trying to bring dollars to the state and trying to make sure we're maintaining our Oregon airports that the state owns that are across the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Rep McLean, thank you. My husband's a pilot and has been flying since he was 25. So our local airport, I believe, in Hermiston is owned not by the state, but owned privately. So are there funds for privately owned airports?
Madam Chair, I really would like to have the director speak to that because she's got more day-to-day knowledge.
Okay, that's fine. If you're in the room with us, just remember when you turn your camera on and your microphone on to state your name for the record.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Betty Stansbury. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation. And to answer the question on Hermiston, if it's privately owned but public use and is eligible for federal funding, then part of our program, the CORE program, will help provide the match for that. If it's not eligible for federal funding, but it's a public use airport, we provide funds for projects that aren't eligible for the federal funding. And if you give me just a moment, I can tell you if we've provided funding for Hermiston. If you will indulge me for about 2 seconds, I can grab the cheat sheet.
Sure.
Okay. Hermiston.
And I want to let people know that we do have two other people signed up as witnesses to testify in the public hearings, so we may get additional information from them. Ms. Stansbury.
Certainly, and I will be brief because I know you've got a very full agenda. So I'm looking at what we funded for Hermiston. It's a city-owned airport, and we have provided funding for them for assistance with their master plan update, and then for an apron rehabilitation, runway protection zone land acquisition, and road relocation project. So we have provided funding to that airport. Not a huge amount, but about $40,000, and that leveraged almost $400,000 in federal funds.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was just curious because we had other people that came in and did a bunch of stuff, and it has really improved our local airport. And we have crop dusters that fly in there all day long, and it needs to be a safe airport for them. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Is that all, Rep. Levy?
Yes, thank you.
Sure. So let's hear now from the two other people who have signed up to testify, J.L. Wilson, followed by Gail J. Jacobs.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson. I'm trying to get my camera to work, but in the meantime, I'll just give you testimony here by audio. I wanted to convey to the committee on behalf of the Oregon Airport Management Association our strong support for House Bill 2434. I believe we need the -4 amendment for this to enable the Department of Aviation to enter into 50-year leases. But just some value add that I had not heard before, because all the testimony has been on point and very good. The first thing is that this is a consensus bill. This has been an industry consensus for almost 2 years. We came to this consensus, in fact, just previous to the short session of 2020. But it's taken us to this point to actually get a bill almost to the finish line. So I did want to convey that this is a consensus bill between the parties in the aviation space. The other thing I wanted to make clear is this is how aviation gets funded in the state of Oregon. And how it works is the monies that come in through the fuel tax and incidentally, it's the 1 cent aviation fuel tax to 3 cents that generates the most money. This is used to leverage FAA money for grants for our public use airports. And the key figure here is we get an almost 9-to-1 match on that money. So when you think about the expense of local airports and capital construction projects and everything it takes to make an airport safe, we're getting $9 from the FAA for every $1 we raise in this tax. So the leverage on this is amazing, and you can see why it would be so catastrophic if it were to sunset starting in 2022. The last thing I will mention with respect to the ROAR program going away in this bill, and that's because over time, I think the FAA determined that some of the things that we were doing with our ROAR program, the FAA was no longer going to allow, such as revenue guarantees for flights to rural airports. So we thought it best to fold the ROAR program into CORE and allow rural uses to be considered along with all the other CORE grant applications. And so that really, it was the impetus for why the ROAR program got folded into CORE. And that number is now 75%. And then of course you have the state airports getting the remaining 25%. So just Airport Management Association strongly in support of this bill. We need it badly, obviously, because the sunset is coming up on us very quickly. So thank you so much for your consideration. Really do support it and hope you move the -4 and move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you as well. And I don't know if we have some technology going awry, but Mr. Wilson, we didn't see you the whole time you were talking. And Ms. Stansberry, we didn't see you either the whole time you were talking. So gosh darn it, but we know who you are, and thank you for identifying yourselves.
Thank you.
Next is Gail Jake Jacobs.
Well, good afternoon, and can you see me?
Not right now.
Well, I was able to see both both of the two previous speakers, Betty and JL. So maybe I'll come online. Yeah, Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm Jake Jacobs. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Aviation Industries. Our organization represents nearly 100 aviation-related businesses across the state, and we're focused on aviation economic development. We support 2434, the aviation amendments, because that's where our funding comes for aviation in Oregon. Without that, the department cannot assist our 97 public use airports across the state. And the current levels are 3 cents a gallon for avgas, or 3 cents a gallon for jet fuel and 11 cents for avgas, one of the lowest in the region, far lower than auto fuel tax, which is how we fund our roads. And it's not a general tax, it's paid for the users of aviation like myself, a private pilot as well. And it will provide, as you've heard, the 1090 match for FAA fundings for 28 of the airports. And because this bill has removed the priorities on the previous bill, not all the money is going to go there. There's going to be a considerable amount of money left for the rural airports and the ones who hadn't been previously served. So this really helps the urban-rural divide situation. Now, we can't use any funding for subsidizing tickets on airplane flights, but we can do some investigation on affordable rural air across the state. The Oregon Business Council, and we've been talking about that a bit. Wouldn't it be nice if you could jump on a plane at your local airport and fly across the state for a few hundred dollars? And with electric aircraft and hybrid and modern aircraft coming along, this is going to happen across the nation, and we could be a leader there. So we want to focus on that with a little bit of this money. This money provides the maintenance and the infrastructure for the airports, the runways, safety, airports are using for emergency preparedness, and some money can be used for that, for natural disaster relief, and overall economic development for the aviation industry in Oregon. So we strongly encourage that you pass this bill. We were out of committee. We were very involved in 2015 in getting an initial bill written. In fact, we were the ones who drafted the original text. And it's essential for the Department of Aviation, for Aviation in Oregon, to continue forward, continuing to receive this funds. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, do you have any questions for those people who have testified? I'll wait just another few seconds. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands. Thank you, everyone, for being with us and providing your public testimony. I'd like to confirm with Legislative Revenue Office staff, were there any others who signed up to testify that I have not called?
No, that was everyone, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Since that completes our list of witnesses, and I don't see any other questions, any last comments from Mr. Malik or anyone else in LRO before I close this public hearing? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment that this is a real important funding stream for rural airports. And my predecessor, she did not vote on any tax bills, but said that this is the one that she did because it helped rural airports. And so I'm glad to see the sunset being considered to be removed and moving this forward. Thank you.
Thanks for the comment, Rep. Reschke. Any other comments before I close this public hearing? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing now on House Bill 2434. Now I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 141A.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern for Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 141A deals with vertical housing zones. And currently there is a partial property tax exemption program for vertical housing zones. And it's based on the calculation of the floors that are used for residential purposes. And so vertical housing is housing that, you know, might have a shop on the main floor and then three apartments above it or something like this. And so so there's some specifics in terms of what would qualify for vertical housing. So there's a zone and then there's a calculation. So for instance, you might have floors that are of different sizes. And so just counting the floors, 1, 2, 3, 4, doesn't account for the square footage. And historically, there's a calculation. And sometimes that square footage ratio for those equalized floors, as they're called, could result in the mixed numeral or a fraction, and you could end up with a number like 2.4 equalized floors for residential purposes. What would happen here with this bill is a couple things that takes that 2.4, for instance, as an example, and applies that number as it is calculated, and then doesn't utilize a threshold. So there was it's a bit of a clarification. There was, some question over whether the number 2 or 2.4 or there should be any rounding. This establishes that there's no threshold number or no rounding. The number would be utilized as calculated. And then it just does some adjustment to the partial property tax schedule. So in current statute, there's sort of a increase of partial property tax exemption based on the equalized floor calculation. So it goes from 20% to 40% to 60% to 80%. And so the sort of change here is they all stay at 20% until you tip the threshold to get to 80%. And then these are all situated within this zone. And then any taxing district that chooses not to participate in this does not have to.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Ms. McGovern before we go to our witnesses? I don't see any. We have one person signed up to testify on Senate Bill 141A. That's Gwen Baldwin.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke and members of the committee. I'm Gwen Baldwin, here today representing Oregon Smart Growth, a coalition of developers, investors, and allied professions committed to walkable, livable residential and employment development that is feasible and sustainable. Oregon Smart Growth supports the modest but important adjustment to the tax exemption portion of the Vertical Housing Development Zone Program in Senate Bill 141A, as well as the clearer language Legislative Council crafted on how the exemption is calculated per project. For new members of the Revenue Committee who may not be familiar with this program, a bit of history. The Vertical Housing Development Zone Program is a state-created local option, locally administered property tax exemption program that encourages increased housing creation within mixed-use development or redevelopment in specific, locally designated areas. The program was created to re-energize downtown Main Street commercial areas with the vibrancy of housing. The zones often include transit service. The tax exemption applies to floors of housing added over commercial space through a calculation of average square footage of a floor in the project and the square footage of residential floors. The result, as Jamie mentioned, is that 20% of the property tax on the building is exempt for each average floor of housing up to four floors, and 20% of the property tax on the land is exempt for each average floor that is affordable at 80% area median income for the duration of the exemption, which is 10 years. Certification of each local program and project used to be approved by the state. First, Business Oregon, when the program was created, and then Housing and Community Services in 2005. This approval step slowed the process for local certification. So in 2017, the legislature approved Senate Bill 310, which moved full administration of this local option tax exemption program to the local governments that choose to use it. A local government choosing to use this mixed-use incentive tool first creates a targeted zone to encourage more housing in areas of commercial development. This is the vertical housing development zone. A local government can designate more than one area of vertical housing development zone. In establishing that zone, a local government must consider the potential impacts to the area's housing costs as new or refurbished housing is developed. Next, the local government works with interested developers and certifies if a project meets the requirements of the program to have both housing and commercial elements, and determines the average square footage for all floors, the number of total floors in the project, as well as the square footage of floors of housing. This provides the information to run the calculation, which provides the multiplier for the tax exemption on the building. The same calculation is run on any affordable housing in the project and applies to the abatement to the land. Functionally, the more floors of housing provided, the bigger the tax exemption, but it never exceeds 80% or four average floors of housing. Last, the county assessor is informed of the exemption calculation, so the property tax exemption is given to the building owner for up to 10 years. The exemption is applied to the current assessed value, as vertical housing development zones do not freeze assessments. Since its inception, the program has been used to incentivize up to four floors of housing above commercial space in locally created zones all over Oregon, including the very first in Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, Medford, The Dalles, Eugene, Hillsboro, Gresham, Beaverton, and most recently, Ashland and Estacada. So that's the background on the program. Senate Bill 141A adjusts the exemption.
Go ahead. Baldwin, I'd like to interrupt for a minute. We have a member who's been wanting to ask a question, and since I don't know how long your testimony is, I'd like to give the floor to Representative Levy now.
Of course, Chair Nathanson. I would say about a minute more, but happy to answer any questions anytime.
Before it gets too late, let's let Rep. Levy get in for a moment.
Well, she may answer my question if she continues her minute.
Okay.
So I'm fine sitting and waiting.
All right.
Thank you. So that's the background of the program. Senate Bill 141A adjusts the exemption calculation to remove a disincentive in the current statutes, which can be read to limit the exemption only to full average floors of housing, rounding down any partial calculation. So if a project calculated out to 3.75 average floors of housing, only a 60% exemption would be given currently, as if there were only three floors of housing, not the nearly 80% exemption for the nearly four average floors of housing provided. How does this happen, and why am I even mentioning average floors? Even though a building may look like four floors of housing over commercial, there may be floors that aren't as large as others due to non-housing purposes. You can only count the housing floors. So things like shared community space, building storage, or stepping back of a floor for desired design reasons. When the calculations are run at the end of construction and the project is certified by the city, the result may include a partial floor of housing. Losing part of a tax exemption that was planned in order to make a project work discourages projects to fully develop housing in these zones or even participate in the program at all, as too risky. Senate Bill 141A revises the state statutes to allow the exemption on improvement or land to reflect the actual average floors calculation, full or percentage. So 3.75 average floors of housing would get the 20% exemption with a 3.75 multiplier, not three. This modest revision ensures a more predictable process, the intended tax exemption without rounding up or down, and less risk for housing providers to participate in this mixed-use incentive program. As Jamie mentioned, Senate Bill 141A also contains clearer language on running the calculation for the exemption multiplier, an amendment made on the Senate side that Oregon Smart Growth supported. Senate Bill 141A passed out of the Committee on Housing unanimously and passed the Senate on a 26-4 vote after unanimous Senate Finance and Revenue approval. I urge your support of Senate Bill 141A, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Ms. Baldwin, so I'm familiar with the LeGrand one because that's in my district. My oldest son and his wife lived in a project similar to that in Long Beach, California. Our youngest son and his wife lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, where they did a complete regentrification of the buildings in the communities in Silver Spring, and they lived on the top. But in both of those situations, they were not allowed to purchase. They could only rent. Is that the same thing for this bill, or are these like condos that somebody could purchase? Or are these strictly on a rental basis?
Chair Nathanson, Rep. Levy, the bill, the statute is silent on the form of housing. It does not require it to be rental per se, but if it is, then you have the issue about the affordability that would be in play. But that would also be in play if it was ownership. You know, is it hitting the mark of 80% area median income? So the point is to get the housing. It's kind of Switzerland on the form.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Nathanson.
Sure. Committee members, any other questions for Ms. Baldwin? I'm not seeing any now. I'd like to confirm with LRO, were there any other people who signed up to testify?
No, there wasn't, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I do see another hand. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Ms. Baldwin, I just have a question out of curiosity, which is you named a number of communities that have adopted vertical housing zones, which is really cool. Do we have any idea how many projects have ever actually been developed statewide, or how many communities have actually had projects developed?
Because it moved from a state-administered certification, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Marsh, because it moved from a state certification to a local certification, there isn't a collector of that data, after 2017. But when I look at the existing vertical housing development zones sort of matrix from 2015, it does show that there were projects, there were zones approved, and there were projects in many, if not most, of these communities. I think some of the challenges for some of the, what I would call, very small town Main Street, where they, you know, early adopters, and Grants Pass, again, being the very first one, and Klamath Falls being the second, they may have run into challenges on the number of projects that they could do because of unreinforced masonry. A lot of these Main Streets are unreinforced masonry, and even the tax exemption isn't going to provide enough if you have to seismically retrofit a pretty unstable brick or building. So there are some limits to the projects, but they have occurred all over the state. And again, I was very excited. I was going to give Ashland bragging rights as the most recent, and then just in the matter of the last week or so, Estacada came right in and approved their zone. And I know other jurisdictions are looking to do so as well. I think this is a true one of the greatest sort of local programs that you can do to really, again, re-energize a commercial area with the housing that the state desperately needs. So hopefully this will give it a little bit more exposure, and we'll have more communities choosing to adopt it.
Thank you.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just have one comment. The city of Pendleton has used this, I believe, quite extensively. My sister-in-law actually lives in a condo above the noisiest bar in the city of Pendleton during Roundup. And that's the only drawback she has from that. But they have it, their condo is beautiful. And the downtown Pendleton area has, they've revitalized the buildings underneath, and they have all of these apartments and building these available living spaces above. And it's really made the city, the downtown portion of Pendleton look, you know, very, very pretty.
Thank you for the comment. Committee members, anything else? Thank you, Ms. Baldwin, for being with us today, for your testimony. I'm not seeing any other questions, and that's all the witnesses for today. So I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 141A. Now we're moving to work sessions. The first work session, I'm opening House Bill 3295.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 3295. You've heard about three times, and this, to refresh your memory, is about the distribution of marijuana revenue between counties and primarily counties with issues that had to deal with the opt-out, opt-in kind of process. You're looking at this time at the -4 amendment, and the -4 amendment allows for the counties that were opting in or allowing businesses, marijuana businesses, before January 1st, 2018, to continue receiving that revenue distribution from the marijuana account. And the same formula would apply, the same formula in the distribution within the counties will apply. And primarily put some conditions. One of them is for any county in the future that would want to opt out or consider opting out is to establish an advisory panel. And also that advisory panel is recommended or necessitated actually in the bill for the ones that did go out between or opted out between 2018 and 2021. So that's the amendment that you have, and I have for you in your packet both a revenue impact and a fiscal impact. And the revenue impact for this amendment is primarily, this is not within a state, but within the for between counties, this would move about $376,880 from the county pot, the 10% that counties receive from the rest of the counties, and allow Deschutes County, that today fits within that description, to start getting that money in a biennium. Now, that amount is fixed because Measure 110, as you recall, kind of fixed the amounts that would go to the marijuana account at $45 million a year or $90 million a biennium. So it cannot go above that. And of course, 10% of that amount would be going to counties, to total, to all counties. So that amount is, I mean, this is probably one of the things that give you certainty from Measure 110, is that that amount is not going to go up. It is always going to be $45 million a year or $90 million biennium, which gives it about $4.5 million for counties each year. So within that, you would have a redistribution of about $376,880 from all other counties, and reallocates that to Deschutes County under this measure. Of course, this all assuming that no new counties go in or out into the opt-in, opt-out kind of process.
Thank you. According to my records, we had a public hearing on March 8th, a work session on April 22nd, a work session on May 25th, and at that work session, we heard about the Dash 4 amendment, which it looks like was written on May 24th. I see Representative Krupp is in the room with us. I'm going to ask you just very briefly, what we have in front of us today, the most recent amendment, Dash 4, is that the same as what you would have explained to us on May 25th?
Good evening, Chair Nathanson and other members of the committee. Jason Krupp from House District 54. Yes, it's the same amendment we discussed last time I was here.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Okay. Committee members, any questions for Mr. Malik? Okay, it's work session time. Any discussion generally, or is there a motion?
I think I see Representative Greg Smith wanting to ask.
I can't see that, but yes, I see a hand. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I don't have a question, and actually I'm about to digress to a point where you may not be happy, but Malik, really good seeing you. I haven't seen you in a while. I hope you're doing well.
Thank you, sir.
I look forward to seeing you in person. Madam Chair, I know that's a digression, but I felt it needed to be said.
Well, thank you. You just made my day.
We're happy to go down that kind of a path with you, Representative Smith. Those courtesies are always welcome. Thank you. Is there a motion? Before I take a motion, did Rep. Marsh have her hand up?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'm just going to jump on the digression that Representative Smith initiated and say, Malik, every time you've been here, I've been trying to figure out where your house or your office was, and now I see Rep. Levy showing up in the same place, so I figured it all out.
She's moving out of her place. I offered her my office.
And I think this was part of one of those vertical housing projects.
Chair Nathanson, I move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3295.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Vice Chair Reschke moves the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3295. Is there discussion on this motion? Not seeing any. Let's have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes on the amendment.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes yes.
Representative Badrama.
Badrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 3295 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Reschke moves House Bill 3295 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I see a hand up.
I think it's Representative Marsh, Madam Chair.
Yeah, all these people who are guests. Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'm sorry to make it more confusing. I used to describe myself facetiously as being the legislator from the land of weed and wine, and now I describe it as the land of wine and weed and weed and weed. Jackson County is, of course, leading the state in the propagation of cannabis. And that means that the hits that we've experienced in the cannabis tax as a result of Measure 110 have had a tremendous impact on us. We would have otherwise expected about $2.2 million in cannabis taxation this year. Instead, we're going to see about $500,000. And we're seeing that at the same time when the burdens of leading the state in cannabis are really very great. It's always been an issue. We've always had concerns around workers from small businesses being diverted to the cannabis business. We've had land that could have been otherwise grown in vegetables diverted to cannabis. We've had fights over water. We've had code compliance issues, and we've had crime. And for the most part, I think it's been something the community has come to reckon with. But most recently, we've had an invasion of, because we are a center of hemp and cannabis, an invasion of, frankly, out-of-state interests coming and growing broadly all over the county and in Jackson County, products that are probably much closer to cannabis than they are to hemp and illegally. And I describe all of that because we're starting to really undermine any kind of reward a county might otherwise receive from engaging in the cannabis and hemp industries. When we still have code compliance issues and sheriff issues and water issues, and our cannabis taxation is dropping from over $2 million to $500,000, at some point, a county has to ask, what's in it for me? I believe that this bill, while it doesn't have a huge financial impact, I think it opens a door to undermining the cannabis industry as we constructed it within this state. And I think it, frankly, is bad messaging to counties that are doing their best to accommodate the industry in all forms, to say that you could walk out of the business, still maintain the taxation that you're getting and not lose anything, I think is not the message that we want. But moreover, I think now is a time when we need to not be picking away at the cannabis tax. Instead, I think we need to undertake a deep study of where this money should be going and how we should empower local communities around the issue of cannabis. Pending over in the Senate side is a bill that we, or the a different version of the same bill that we did not move forward, which was to allow our very rural counties to impose their own cannabis taxation because of specific conditions in those counties. We have lots of options, lots of ways we can pick away at this tax, lots of efforts that have already happened. And rather than allowing those to go forward, I think we should call a halt and we should undertake the study that we've probably, frankly, been overdue with for a couple of years, really looking at cannabis taxation and trying to figure out how this is going to work for both the state and for local communities, particularly if we look forward to the legalization of cannabis across the country, which will just put tremendous additional pressure on local communities. So I'm going to oppose the bill, but I do want to applaud the bill's chief sponsor for really making every effort. We've had many robust and entertaining conversations around this legislation, but when it comes down to it, I just have a county with very different needs, and so I'll be opposing the bill.
Thank you. Representative Smith, I saw your hand up earlier.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I was going to share a few comments, but after listening to Representative March, it's obvious I don't have the knowledge or experience on this issue. And so I'm going to back away from the comments I was going to share. But I do want the good carrier to know that I'm going to support this bill today. I think the good representative has worked hard on this issue, and I think for his neighborhood, if you will, this is a good piece of legislation that will help him and the folks that he was elected to serve. So thank you, Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. Discussion from anyone else? I'm going to chime in now then. Certainly, there has been adverse impact on local governments and their programs from the passage of Measure 110. I believe that when the voters were reviewing that measure, a large part of the aspect of funding and revenue streams and how programs would be paid for was just not understood because it wasn't a major talking point in the campaign. But I believe that even though there were those adverse impacts on local governments, I don't think this is the bill that would solve it or exacerbate it. There's got to be another way to address the issues that have arisen from this drastic reduction in revenue to local governments and their programs. Some of you on this committee will recall that there were a number of bills assigned to House revenue this year. We had House Bill 2014 from Representative Owens, House Bill 2015 from Representative Owens, House Bill 2294 from Representative Morgan, House Bill 3175 from Representative Brock Smith, House Bill 3210 from Representative Owens. Some of those would have expanded what can be taxed from marijuana items or wholesale sales across county borders, increasing the maximum percentage of the tax, changing the distribution of the funding. After we had our public hearing on several of those bills, it was very obvious that there was an interrelationship between some of those bills, increasing taxes, expanding what could be taxed, distribution among cities and counties and for different programs. It also was obvious that we were talking not only about revenue issues and methods of taxation, but we were talking about issues that were under the purview of the General Government Committee, for example, which deals with our local government partners, things that would have been in the purview of the Judiciary Committee because it related to enforcement, issues that related to economic development that would have been in another committee. So after hearing all of those, and after hearing even at least one of the bill sponsors say, it's not ready for prime time on these, we need a work group, I indicated my intent to indeed figure out a way to work with Representative Wilde from General Government and perhaps others to figure out the right kind of work group to take the deep dive. I certainly appreciate very much what Representative Marsh has talked about in some detail with us this afternoon. There does need to be a work group. There does need to be a deeper discussion. And I think it should go beyond just this committee because it involves a whole lot of stuff beyond just taxation methods. So, all of that said, please understand I am committed to advocating for and helping figure out how to get a work group appointed that should start work this summer, let's say. It should be working at least as soon as this interim. I'm not talking about something far into the future, but for now, I do support this bill because I think it's the right thing to do on this one very narrow topic. Okay. Anyone else with comments on this bill? Let's have a vote. Roll call vote, please.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes no.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes no.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes yes.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. Assigning a carrier for the House, that would be Representative Krupp. Thank you. Is there any other business on this bill? I think we've taken care of the details on this. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3295. As mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, I'm carrying over House Bill 2070. The next work session is House Bill 2456, and I anticipate this work session is for discussion only. We're not ready with paperwork for motions and votes. So House Bill 2456.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, House Bill 2456, we don't have the paperwork for it at this time. We do have, this is an omnibus measure that the committee heard last week. We do have a dash three amendment that just makes a couple tweaks to the dash two that was discussed last week. But again, in the meeting materials on OLIS, you'll find a section contents. The one pager that lists each of the section by section description. And in this case, the text in red would refer to the changes since the dash two amendment that was discussed in the committee last week. But again, just the two changes that are being made are very technical changes. The first is just an applicability date. Some of this, the language here in 2456 was actually from the 2020 legislative session. So we caught a date change related to applicability. That's in section 15, the change there. And the last change has to do with the short line railroad credit and just including some statutory cross-reference corrections and then also removing some of the redundant statute. And just have received a couple of questions on this, and this just relates to the transferability and the certification of that short line railroad credit. So there was legislation last session when the credit was, or two sessions ago when the credit was created, the short line credit was created, that covers the certification requirements, how an agency would work with Department of Revenue, and also the transferability. So that language already exists in statute, and that's why it's being removed from the statute specific to that Shoreland Railroad credit. But I know there had some emails and there's some confusion there. So just wanted to put that out there that these really are just removing some unneeded statute that's contained in the ORS right now. But again, those are the two changes that have been modified to the dash two amendment. Otherwise, you'll see all the changes again in that document available on OLIS.
Thank you. Committee members, this is a bill with a lot of different sections. Any questions for Mr. Easton? Representative Levy.
Kyle, I cannot tell you how relieved I am that the short line is still in there, because this weekend I had so many phone calls relating to short line railroads and how they were going to impact my communities and it was like crazy. So I'm incredibly relieved. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Levy, I think I got only half as many emails or calls that you got. But yes, they wanted to make that very clear that it's just the redundant pieces of the statute, but those exist already in the ORS. So they're unneeded. It really is a change there.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, just to clarify, this bill with its 29 sections is mostly a technical fix bill. We're not seeing wide swings in policy. It's a cleanup bill, if you will, removing redundant parts and clarifying language. Is that correct? Is that a fair characterization, I should say?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, I think that's mostly correct. One thing we are looking at in a little more detail right now is a relatively late addition that came through. It's sections 21 through 24, and it is an expansion of an existing exclusion of capital gains. In this case, the existing law is related to manufactured dwelling parks that are sold to a tenant association of those parks. There is a capital gains exclusion available in Oregon to encourage the sale of those parks to those tenant associations. In this case, the language being provided here would allow the sale of these parks that have been damaged or destroyed due to predominantly the discussion has been wildfires, but it would be, it is, we are pointing to the definition in House Bill 3219 related to a manufactured park that's been destroyed by a natural disaster. But it is designed to provide that same capital gain exclusion if these parks are, these ones that have been destroyed, are sold to a nonprofit organization or a housing authority that will then, the idea is to rebuild these parks that have been destroyed.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Rep. Reschke, just to respond, to add a little bit more detail to Kyle's notation there, in many cases, we no longer have, the current statute references groups of tenants, and in the cases of these wildfires, we have no groups of tenants, and yet we know we still have nonprofits that would work, plan to work with tenants and reestablish parks that are tenant-owned or tenant and tenant-managed. But there, what we realized that was a barrier in using the capital gains benefit at this point. So the clarification is to simply note that in these under these conditions, there may not be a tenant group associated with the purchaser.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Rep. Marsh. That's really helpful. Anyone else? I'll wait a few more seconds to see if we have any other discussion on this one. I'm not seeing any new hands up. At the end of about 5 seconds, I'm going to close the work session on this bill, and we'll have a work session to consider moving it at our next meeting.
Let's all raise our hand. I'll meet.
Rep. Marsh, is that you? Okay. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2456. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2438.
Madam Chair, Chris Allenek, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2438 is going to be a gut and stuff, and I'm basically going to hand it over to Representative Smith. There is a dash three amendment that got placed into OLIS just 15 minutes before the meeting started.
Great. Rep. Smith, tell us about the amendment.
Wonderful. Thank you. First of all, Madam Chair, thank you for your leadership. And for the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith, representing District 57, which includes some of the most frontier and smallest counties in the state. And so one of the things, gang, we heard after I was able to participate in an informational hearing was that there was some concern about the income eligibility for the housing. And so without getting too public, Representative Pham and Representative Nathanson and myself and Lori at the OEA, we had a conversation and said, what's a more appropriate rate? And so originally, the income eligibility rate was tied to $125,000 for single filers, $250,000 for joint. And that rate was derived from back in 2009 when we were raising the personal income tax on the wealthiest of Oregon. That was the rate that was utilized. But after reflection and after some input from the folks I just mentioned, it's apparent to me that we need to lower that rate from $150 down to $75 for single filers, and from $250 down to $150 for joint filers. And with that said, Madam Chair, nothing else in the bill has changed. It's simply part of the program of everyone gives a little. And this is a chance for us to try and build a few affordable homes in the smallest counties of Oregon. Again, colleagues, I'd remind you, this is for only counties under 15,000. And the goal is to try and get some kids in our school, to attract some folks to rural Oregon, and to build some middle-income homes. So that's where we have before us. And I'm pleased to announce, since I brought this forward the last time, NECA has come on board supporting this project in addition to the OEA, the home builders, et cetera.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. We heard about this. We got a lot of really good detail and description at our informational meeting. We don't have the paperwork that we need to consider moving this bill tonight, but committee members, do you have any questions or any other kind of discussion before we close the work session for today? We will have this on the agenda for our next meeting. That's correct, Mr. Alanak. It's already, we've got this posted.
Madam Chair, I don't know if we have it posted at this moment, but we will.
Thank you. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to express appreciation for this solution to a problem that I think many localities across the state face, where the cost of construction is higher than the eventual sale price. And I just appreciate more solutions and more thinking outside the box as we address this really urgent housing crisis that we face. And it looks different. It looks different in my district than it looks in Rep. Smith's district, but yeah, I appreciate this. This is one potential tool in what we're going to need, many different tools to address this housing crisis.
It's very kind. Thank you.
I'm not seeing any other hands. I'm closing today's work session on House Bill 2438. Oh, Rep. Reschke, sorry.
No, that's fine, Madam Chair. I wanted to make a comment just to make sure that I'm clear, we're carrying over House Bill 2070, we're carrying over House Bill 2456, and we're carrying over House Bill 2438. Is that correct?
I don't know if I needed to use the words carry over because we are posting work sessions for them. I just want to make sure that, thank you for being on your toes about that. And I will just confirm with Mr. Alanak that everything's copacetic.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The posting requirements are different now that sine die has been declared imminent. So it really, from a practical sense, it doesn't matter if they're carried over or not. We'll get them posted tomorrow. Whatever's not posted, and we'll get it up to date tomorrow.
Thank you.
Great. And I'm very appreciative of the teamwork on House revenue, making sure that we get our business done the right way.
It's a good committee.
And the last work session that was posted on the agenda was House Bill 2447. I don't intend to hear that bill tonight, and instead, I want to tell you what I have in mind. As we were hearing about the bill, and I dug into it, talked with a couple other people also, a number of questions arose. It was unclear to me that we would or could be ready as a committee to vote to extend this particular tax expenditure. Here's a list of questions that started to come up for me. What was the original intent of this special assessment? And has it been successful in accomplishing what the intent was? How has this incentive been used in the past? And what could it be used for going into the future? When we say historic property, are we trying to preserve history or are we trying to preserve architecture? An architecturally ordinary structure or site might still be significant in the state's history, but if it's to preserve architecture, to what extent are we allowing alterations and design changes? To what extent does this provision exacerbate or even just perpetuate the inequities in the property tax system? The incentive might be useful as a tool for economic development or for civic pride, but those are both different from historic preservation. So should this particular tool be retooled? Should it be repurposed? And finally, what kind of property types should be eligible? Residential, commercial, industrial, some other kind of structures? Should it be anything and everything, or should it be limited? There were suggestions about limiting it. I have asked Representatives Valderrama and Levy to lead a work group. And I have asked LRO, Legislative Revenue Office, to staff the effort. I think that there are a number of stakeholders who could be consulted and people interested, for example, in local history, such as county historical societies or museums. Certainly SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Office. Another stakeholder would be local jurisdictions that could either benefit from the rehabilitation of properties or, on the other hand, could lose property tax revenue. So I thank you for our committee members who've agreed to be a work group to study this. If the work group determines that the special assessment should be continued with or without modification, the work group, I believe, should be prepared to make a proposal to our committee by November of this year, so that we could consider then a committee bill for 2022. This special assessment does continue through June of 2022, halfway into the next year. I want to confirm with Mr. Alanak or Ms. McGovern that that date is correct. Does it expire, what, about July 1st of 2022?
Applications can be accepted up until June 30th, Chair Nathanson.
Thank you. So we do have some time to work on this before considering what should be extended on this historic property special assessment. But committee members, I am certainly happy to hear from you if you have additional concerns about this bill, about delaying it, about what a work group should cover. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I actually just wanted to express my support for this step. I actually was feeling some misgivings about it and just wanting to dig deeper into the implications. We know that there's so many implications with history and culture, what history and culture is honored and protected. And so I just I strongly support taking some time to delve deeper into the implications of these historic property exemptions so we can be really thoughtful as we think about how to shepherd public funds. So thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. Anybody else on this topic? Committee members, thank you for your understanding on this one. I believe we have concluded our business for tonight. Mr. Alanak, is there anything else that we need to do or anything you'd like to tell us about before we adjourn?
No, Madam Chair, we will get, as you just mentioned, we'll get an updated agenda posted as soon as we can.
Okay, thanks. Committee members, yes, Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear on the schedule going forward, are we going to meet on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, or is that still TBD?
My understanding is we're not meeting on Tuesday. You will be meeting on Wednesday as House Revenue. And Thursday is kind of the switch night. It can be House Revenue or JTAX. My understanding for this week is that it'll be JTAX. So House Revenue this week has one more meeting Wednesday. JTAX has two meetings, Thursday evening and Friday afternoon.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep, that's the plan as I understand it right now. But when sine die is imminent, we all just keep looking at messages on our phones and watching our email. Thank you, everybody. We're adjourned.
Bye-bye.